Today, we are supposed to be doing the four seals of the Buddha's Buddha's teachings, the four seals. First of all, out of numerous teachings the Buddha gave, these four teachings are referred to as the four seals of the Buddha's teaching. You may wonder why. Why being so selective of these four? So these are known as the seals. Say, there could be some teachings of the Buddha, which may not hold true in some other time, you know, frame of time, or with some other individuals, it may not hold true. Say, someone who is least interested in generosity, then the Buddha encourages the person, saying that, oh, generosity is the best of the virtues. So why don't you do that? So you are going to miss the best of the opportunity for one's own benefit. So here, to encourage the person in a very skillful way, the Buddha said that the generosity is the top most important practice. And whereas, for someone else who is so keen on the practice of generosity, and yet not being so keen on observing ethical discipline, so that teaching that is on that the Buddha has given to the first person may not hold true in the case of the second person. Because for the second person, there is no need to encourage in generosity. So there he needs to encourage in ethical discipline. So there, in the second case, he might say that, oh look, generosity is so good, but what use that is of if you don't observe ethical discipline? Because not observing the ethical discipline, then you're going to end up taking birth in the lower realms. So the practice of generosity that you have put so much effort in is going to ripen its result in the lower realms. So in which case you are unable to really invest that practice of generosity to multiply, because they in the lower realms you don't know how to multiply the virtues. So it's simply consuming the results of the virtue that you have accumulated, and then eventually that virtue is going to be exhausted. So ethical discipline is the top priority. So again, you see that there is different teaching coming up. So these teachings may not necessarily be in line with everyone's interest, and may not hold true in all contexts. However, the four teachings that you see under the heading, the four seals of the Buddha's teaching, they hold true in all respect. Whether you are in 20th century, whether you are in 25th century, or 30th century, or 9th century, or 1st century, these four teachings hold true at all times. And not just for one individual, but for everyone. So therefore, these four teachings are known as the seals of the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha sealed, saying that there is never any compensation. There's never any kind of, you know, the alteration required for these teachings. So this is what is fixed, what I'm sealing, to say that these four teachings will hold true as beneficial and as true at all times for everyone at any place. So therefore, these four teachings, they form the whole framework of the Buddha Shakyamuni's teachings for the benefit of oneself and all other sentient beings. Okay, now what are these four teachings? And there could be more than that, which, you know, hold true and which is also beneficial to oneself and others. Then why only four? Again, if the number exceeds, you know, if the number is so much, then we can easily get discouraged. Or we are hopeless students. It's hopeless to really be able to catch up with all these things. So these four, in terms of number, is so small. And on top of that, these four can rightly encapsulate the complete form of one's practice. So this is the beauty of this teaching. So what are these four seals? So as we all know, but of course there is going to be a little bit of difference in terms of translation. Generally we can say all composite things. Some translators can offer you the translation compounded. These two just mean same. All composite things are impermanent, number one. Number two, all contaminated things are of the nature of suffering. Number three, everything is of nature of emptiness and selflessness. And finally, transcending sorrow is peace and ultimate virtue. Transcending sorrow is peace and ultimate virtue. So now let's see how these four teachings encapsulate the entire path and the entire spectrum of the Buddha's the practice that we are to do so that we get to the state of nirvana or enlightenment. And this same teaching, the teaching on these four seals, can be expanded to all other teachings. And they can be, again, all other teachings can be, again, abbreviated or shortened in these four seals of the Buddha's teaching. First one, all composite things are of impermanent nature. In fact, before delving in this point, what we need to know is that what for we have to practice Dharma? One. What for you are, you know, sleeping? What for you are taking your breakfast? Or what for you do things that you like? Eventually, the answer is going to boil down to, I want happiness. This is the ultimate answer. Say, someone, you know, Obama and who is that guy? McCain. They are fighting for votes. Why? If you ask them, if you push them with this question, eventually they will come up with the answer that I want happiness. I think this is how I'm going to gain happiness. And if you ask a Bodhisattva, why are you giving your limbs? Why are you giving everything away to everyone else? Again, they will say, it makes me happy to see others happy. Again, finally, it is, you know, it makes me happy. Again, if you ask the Buddha, the same thing. Why did you strive so much, three countless eons, ready to give up everything? Again, the same answer. To benefit all the other sentient beings. What is that if you are able to benefit all the other sentient beings? Or this is the greatest gift that I can expect. I'm more happy to see others happy. But the way you try to use, you try to gain your goal, the happiness for oneself, differs in among the different individuals. So some, the least intelligent ones, the more ignorant ones, they think that it is by pushing others away that you gain the benefit, you gain the happiness. And whereas the more intelligent ones, like Bodhisattvas and Buddhas, they know the reality. They know that it is not by pushing others, but by embracing others that you get the greatest benefit, greatest joy, right? So eventually we see that, after all, we see that it is our innate desire for happiness. The next question, So this is again the beauty of Buddhism. You always keep on asking questions. Always keep on asking questions. So now we come to know that the happiness is the ultimate thing which drives everyone to move here and there, which drives the Buddhas work for the welfare of sentient beings, which drives the robbers to steal others' things and whatnot. So this is the ultimate thing. Now the question is, the next question you should be able to ask yourself if you want to have a very sound meditation going on. So next question is, I see, actually deep down what I'm seeking is happiness for myself. What degree of happiness you are seeking? 10%? 20%? 50%? 100%? If possible, 100%. The next question, is it possible that 100% happiness is what you're going to achieve? What you can achieve? All these are questions you have to ask. So through asking questions, then the answer that you get becomes so candid and clear. Right? So, to resolve this question well, whether you can get 100% happiness, whether or not you can get 100% happiness, the Buddha said that we have to first of all know what is the obstacle to achieving that 100% happiness. Do we have 100% happiness now? No, we don't have. Which means that it's so obvious. It's also obvious that the obstacle to achieve the 100% happiness is there within us, so intact. This is a clear indication. So now our job is to explore what is that obstacle which comes in the way to achieving the 100% happiness. So we see that it's not just the physical body which comes in the way to achieving the 100% happiness. Something to do with the mind. You are in the same house, you are with the same, you know, the companions, and yet sometimes you feel so, you know, happy. Sometimes you feel so sad, low-spirited. What is that? It's not the physical thing that is determining that. It is just your own mental thinking. So, it must be something there within my mind. The obstacle must be there within my mind. So what is that? Again, we have to examine. Say, just a very simple example. There's just a rosary on the table, and you perceive that as a snake. And naturally, there's going to be fear in your mind. And whereas, even if there's a real snake there, but this watch is not going to be afraid of the snake. So, but whereas the human beings, they are afraid. So what is that? What is the difference? Because we have a special faculty known as mind, which can sense it, which fears, and which feels happy when it is not there, and so forth. So it is a mind. It is a mind. And on top of that, when you start perceiving the rosary to a snake, then there's a fear coming in you. Right? So this fear is what we dislike to have. It's so painful. It's so painful. Just imagine someone being about to be hanged. So look at his physical appearance. It's so sad. It's so desperate. You don't like to even just have the appearance of it. You know, you feel so pity, so compassion. So similar is the case, which is nothing but because of fear of losing himself or herself. So look, so this fear, with this example, this fear is given rise to by this misconception. So similarly, in a like manner, the Buddha said that all fears, all dissatisfactions, all unhappinesses, the opposite of happinesses, they are eventually rooted to what is known as ignorance, misconception of our own mental thinking. Right? So, for this question as to what is the obstacle that comes in the way to achieving 100% happiness, the Buddha points to the ignorance as the final obstacle to which comes in the way to achieving 100% happiness. Say, as soon as this misconceiving, this rosary for a snake, as soon as this misconception is eliminated, removed, the fear automatically disappears. Right? So say, you see this rosary as a snake, and then there's a fear in you. And I'm going to simply pray, oh, may this snake run away, so that I will not have fear. It's useless. So the wisest thing to do is to come to know that this is not a snake. If you come to know that, if you're able to cultivate this realization, the knowledge, which realizes the reality that this is not a snake, this is a rosary. If you come to realize that, then the fear immediately dissolves. You don't have to do anything else to remove this fear. Simply remove the cause of that fear, and the fear will diminish on its own. So in a like manner, what is the opposite of 100% happiness? It is the 100% pain, or the non-100% happiness, right? So what is that triggered by? Which spurs, you know, what spurs are that non-happiness? It is nothing the Buddha points to as the ignorance, which is the root cause of all this dissatisfaction. So our job is to simply get rid of this ignorance, and dissatisfaction will all diminish on their own. Diminishing of the dissatisfaction at all degrees is what is known as accomplishing the 100% happiness. So our job, it becomes so simple now. It becomes so clear now. Our job is to eliminate the ignorance within us. So what could be the next question? The next question is, what is this ignorance? After knowing what this ignorance is, the next question is what you came up with. How to eliminate it. Right? Okay. So the Buddha points to this ignorance is the root cause of all pains, dissatisfaction, suffering, jealousy, attachment, aversion, anticipation, and so forth. So, the actual practice is not as simple as what I said. So in terms of the actual practice, it is not as beautiful as what is put up there on the blueprint. So in reality, they're all different, you know, things, details involved. Similarly, this ignorance, although I put everything as just ignorance, in true sense, there are various degrees of ignorances. So one of the worst of the ignorance that traps us in all these dissatisfaction is viewing impermanent phenomena as permanent. Viewing all composite things as permanent. Primarily oneself as so permanent and everlasting. Say, I came here just for a few days, 1 week. And what would you think if I try to buy refrigerators and for these things for that small cabin? What do you think? Is he mad? Is he insane? He's here just for a few days. You know, just to install, you know, these things. And the, air conditioner. Even to install it will take, you know, a few weeks. So what point is there? You're there just for a few days. So if you're insane, if you're not insane, if you're sane, you're not going to do these things. Because you know that you are simply a traveler. You know, you are simply there as a guest. Few days guest. Right? You're not going to do things which will take you weeks and months, whereas you're going to be there just for a few days. It's just foolish. Right? So, whereas, I don't know that I'm going to be here just for a few days. And then somehow rumor has it that I'm to be here for 10 years. Actually, I'm here just for a few days. But I don't know that. And then, then I started complaining about that cabin. I need a refrigerator, I need AC, air conditioner and these things. And then whatever money I have, I request Alec to get something from, Spokane or from Seattle. And then person, they say, the contractor says that, the AC is going, it'll take 2 weeks to get there. And then another 1 week to fix, And then I say, it's okay, I'll be here for 10 years. Then I send all the money already given, no refundable. And then, before the AC actually arrives here, then somebody tells me, oh, tomorrow is your time. Car is ready. What? You are just for a few days. This is a letter from the Office of His Holiness. I see. So, when I think that I'm going to really last here for a prolonged period of time, then I'll start planning. So in the course of planning, if Alec asked someone else, Peter, to do it for that, and Peter said, oh no, I have some other obligations, then I really get agitated. And whereas, say, Alec, said that Alec asked Jambal to do it, and Jambal very enthusiastically do it, does it, then, I feel so happy. So there's a sense of attachment, aversion. In the course of planning, then all emotions, negative emotions arise. And because of these negative emotions, karmas are accumulated. It's all because, you see, now look, these karmas eventually will ripen into again suffering. It'll keep on in the form of chains of suffering, ripples of suffering. So they're given rise to by the karma, which in turn by accumulated because of my negative emotions such as hatred towards, disliking towards Peter for not being able to, for not being considerate enough to do something for me, and being a sense of, liking towards Jambal for doing things so efficiently, and these things. So in the course of planning, then I accumulate karma because of these negative emotions arising in the course of planning. And these negative emotions arise, why? Because of my, misconception. Because of my misconception that I'm going to last here for a few months, for a few years. It is for the next 10 years. It is because of this misconception that all negative emotions are given rise to, which in turn gave rise to karmas, which in turn gave rise to the next suffering in samsara. So we see that eventually that is rooted to what? My remaining here for 10 years. So similarly, worse than that would be, I would be eternally existent. Not just 10 years. Eternally existent. I'm permanent. So this triggers all negative emotions. You then tend to plan, plan to live for 1,000 years. You know that we are going to not live for the next 80 years. Intellectually, we know that. But on the experience level, on the feeling level, we don't agree with that. We think that we're going to live for 1,000 years, 2,000 years, like that. And accordingly, we plan. Right? So whereas, it is because of this misconception that we're so permanent, eternally existent. For example, I'm here. So, I don't know whether you call me young or old or middle-aged or whatever, but say I expect myself to live for another, 40, 50, 60 years like that. But in true sense, who knows? I'm going to disappear from this world tomorrow. Who knows? Some of you might be weeping tomorrow for me, disappearing, having disappeared from this world. Who knows? We don't know. This is a fact. So if you know this, not only know this, but if we really reflect on it and then transfer this, integrate this, and translate that into our emotional level, into our experiential level, then we see that just as someone who knows, myself knowing that I'll be here just for a few days, I don't even think of getting, refrigerators and, AC and these things for this small cabin. I'm not going to plan this. Because I don't plan this, the afflictions which can potentially arise in, you know, associated while planning will not be there. Because of which, karma is not accumulated. Because of which, I don't have to undergo the experiences of pain of this karma. So we see that if you realize how transitory you are, then you don't plan for the sake of oneself. But of course, there could be qualms. Then what about planning for the benefit of other sentient beings? Of course, do it. So the bodhisattvas, when it comes to themselves, you know, when it comes to themselves, then they simply reflect about the transitoriness of themselves. And whereas when it comes to others, others is not just one individual person. One person goes and the second person will come. So you plan just not just for one person, but for the benefit of, you know, all the other beings bound to come. So for the bodhisattvas, in terms of oneself, you should be well aware of the fact that the transitoriness of oneself. And in relation to other beings, you plan, you do everything. You know, for example, the Srivasti and the Venerable Children is taken care of. This is how the bodhisattvas really should be doing. Right? So, there's no qualm. Anyway, the basic foundation of Buddhism, the teaching of the Buddha, says that it is the first misconception which thinks that you are permanent. You are so, you are non-transitory. You are so eternal. You are so permanent. Which then will lead to plan for oneself. Because of which, then all afflictions, all delusions, attachment, aversion, and so forth can arise. And the corresponding karmas are accumulated, which you have to account for in the future lifetimes. So therefore, the first one says that all composite things are impermanent, in true sense, as opposed to what we feel the reality is, that all composite things, including yourself, is impermanent, which means undergoes changes. They are of the nature of transitoriness. And this impermanence has two levels, the gross level and the subtle level. The gross level is in terms of discontinuing the continuum, ceasing of the continuum. For example, the tree grows and after 10 years or 100 years, then the tree dies. It becomes dry and then is over. So there's the discontinuation of the tree of 100 years or 1,000 years. So that discontinuation is discontinuation of the continuum of a particular object is what is known as the gross impermanence. For example, ourselves. Say a child is born 40 years ago and now is a middle-aged man or woman. And then after 10, 20, 30 years, going to, you know, and disappear from this earth. So, after, say, the person dies at the age of 80 or 60. So at that point, the person discontinues to remain as a person. So there's a discontinuation of the continuum of that person. This is what is known as the gross impermanence. Right? So, the Buddha, when he says that all composite things are of impermanent nature, we have to reflect both the grosser impermanence and the subtler impermanence, right? So if we reflect on the grosser impermanence first, then the subtler impermanence will make sense and can possibly come in your mind, and because of which there would be a very strong desire, urge for the practice of Dharma coming about. So now let's see how. First, we have to meditate on the grosser level of impermanence, which is our death, the death of ourselves. Anyway, you know, one day there's going to be our coming to an end. So then what will happen to you? Are you prepared for the next life? All these questions, right? Say a tree, it grows, you know, it is planted in 1,000 years, right? 1,000 years, 1,000. And then now it is 2008, which means 1,008 years has lapsed. So the tree is as old as 1,080 years. Now it dries. It dries, it is no more green. So a tree which lasted for 1,080 years has now ceased to live as a fresh tree. So this, you know, discontinuation of the continuum of this fresh tree is what is known as the grosser level of impermanence of the tree. Now, in order to have that impermanence, grosser level of impermanence, then it must be because of the presence of subtle impermanence involved. How? Say, the tree which 1,800 years ago, it was just a seedling. Now, not only that it has grown to a gigantic sized tree, it is also, you know, it's also dried. So, now imagine, so this tree which grew to the size of, say, 10 feet, right, 10 feet, say, it took, you know, 1,000 years. Which means that it's not that for the last 1,000 years it always remained as a seedling, and then today it all of a sudden grew to that size. Is this the case? No. So, if it is 10, if it say it is 100 feet tall, 100 feet tall. So this is for the last 1,000 years, it grew from a seedling to a 1,000 feet tall tree. Right? Which means that every 10 years, it grew to one foot. Right? Every 10 years. Which means in 100 years, it's 100 feet. In 1,000 years is 100, sorry, in 100 years is 10 feet tall. In 1,000 years is 100 feet tall, right? So, it, you know, for 1 foot to grow, it took 10 years. Again, is it the case that 1 foot tall tree, is it the case that for the last 9 years, you know, 9 years, 364 days, and it remained a seedling. Then all of a sudden, the next day is going to be 10th year. Then it grew to 1 foot? No. Again, say, every year there's, how to divide it? Say that one foot, you divide it into 10 pieces. The first piece took 1 year. It took 1 year to grow to that first piece of one foot. And then you go on like this. You go on like this. Then you see that the changes is there happening within years, within months, within days, within hours, minute, second, millisecond. And then you can still go on like that. And then we see that change means, you know, it's not remaining static. It's like this. Say, if the changes are there, you know, from second to second, it's like this. Millisecond, like this. Still subtler, like this. So the change that was undergoing in that tree is not like this. It's like this. Moving like this. Similarly, our body, our mind, moving like this. If you really reflect on it with this logic, you try to shorten the length of the time. You try to break the length of the time into smaller and smaller and smaller pieces for its growth or for its, you know, the maturation. Then we see that, you know, eventually, so first, like some of the digital watches. So mind watch is what, like that. The first minute it will always remain like that. After 1 minute it will go like this. And again remain like that for 1 minute. So then you imagine that in terms of second, what it will do? Like this. Then you break that into milliseconds, what it will do? Like that. Still subtler, what it will do? Like this. Still subtler. I cannot even do it. Actually, in true sense, our body, our mind, ourselves, everything is going in this pace. This is what is known as the subtle impermanence. If you reflect on it so well, then there is a sense of fear arising in you. There's nothing to hold on to as, you know, I or self. By the time you try to hold on to yourself as I, it already disintegrates to something else. So because of which, this is really a very powerful, you know, meditation. Say, I feel so attached to this watch. I feel so attached to this watch. Say, right? So, this attachment is primarily given, rooted to my misconception that it remains, it is so permanent. It is unchanging. But in actuality, the reality is that through the logic that I have given you right now, just as, you know, that tree is undergoing that change, this watch also is undergoing this change. Likewise, myself, the agent, is also undergoing this change. Right? So, when you feel attached to it, this means that you like to have it. Well, you go and grasp it. So say, the first moment you attach to that watch which existed in the first moment, then you want to get that first moment watch. By the time your hand reaches there, the first moment of the watch is no more there. So this means, you know, in true sense, the reality is that it's impermanent. So it makes no sense. It is totally contradictory to the reality of the watch and how our attachment looks at the watch. By the time you get there, your hand reaches there, what you really desire has already disintegrated. It's no more there. And the person, and likewise the agent, yourself, you think that, oh, by first of all reaching to the watch, and you get it, and you put that under your possession, you keep that under your possession, thinking that you are permanent. You are the same person who thinks you're going to get it, and who already get it. You think that it's just the same person. But in true sense, by the time you go, you stretch your arms to get it, the person who wants to have that watch has also disintegrated. So what's the point? So the impermanent agent, misconceived, misled of the reality of oneself and the watch, thinking that oneself and the watch both exist as permanent, and then you try to get it. So actually, in terms of the agent, yourself as the agent also disintegrates by the time you reach there. And the watch, also what you really want to have, has also disintegrated. So the impermanent agent wanting to have an impermanent object. So this is the kind of logic put forth in Shantideva's text. What sense is there when an impermanent object wants to have an impermanent, you know, impermanent agent wants to have an impermanent transitory object? So this attachment has no basis at all. So similarly, this needs to be extended to the second point and third point and so forth. Okay, so this is what we need to reflect, you know, how we reflect on the impermanent nature of all composite things, on the grosser level and on the subtler level. And of course, we need to know that in terms of the person, or in terms of mind in general, you cannot think of your mind in general. You know, we cannot think of the grosser level of impermanence. Can you think of that? Because the mind in general will never come to an end. There's no discontinuation of the continuum of the mind. You agree with me or not? The mind, do you think that it will ever come to an end? No, for the time being, no. No, it will never come to an end. It is Vaibhashika who believes that after achieving nirvana, when you die, the mind will annihilate. Otherwise, the rest of the Buddhist schools, and not the rest of the Buddhist schools, the Chittamatra and Mandarin school, the Chittamatra and the Middle East school, the two high schools, from their point of view, the mind always continues, right? So if you take the mind into consideration, you can think of the subtle impermanence, but not the gross impermanence, right? Okay, this is one thing. So now, what is there if you know you come to know that everything, all composite things are impermanent? What is there? Even the Buddha, you know, Buddha Shakyamuni is also impermanent. But why should we feel so, you know, sad? The Buddha is also impermanent. Buddha Shakyamuni is also impermanent. But we think of the Buddha Shakyamuni, this also delighted us. Even if you think about the impermanence of the Buddha Shakyamuni, the subtle impermanence of the Buddha Shakyamuni, there's nothing that we should feel sad about. Then why should you meditate on this impermanence of the composite things? Okay, then what is next? What is the next point? All contaminated things are of suffering nature. So, then this question leads to the next teaching. Next point, right? Okay, when you say all composite things are impermanent, simply don't fantasize yourself with the Buddha, Shakyamuni and these things. Think of yourself. Say, you are under, you know, you are under a very kind boss. Then you are happy. And the boss leaves, you know, for holiday. And he's coming after 2 days. The moment you think of him coming to, you know, coming to join the job, you feel more happy. I have someone to complain. All these things. Whereas, now imagine. Imagine, the boss is so cruel, and he simply seeing you slaps you all the time. Would you be happy? No. So say he goes away on holiday for 2 days. Will you be happy or unhappy? You'll be so happy. And then it's just 1 hour that he's coming. Would you be happy? No. You'll become sad. So similarly, so if the boss is cruel and so bad, why are you unhappy? Because you know that you're going to suffer under this boss. So similarly, whereas the boss goes away for good, would you be happy? Yes, because you don't have to, you know, be sad anymore. Because the boss has left you permanently. But unfortunately, the boss is coming in 1 hour. So similarly, we are impermanent, and impermanent means we undergo change. Change means changing by dependence on causes, and the causes are our bosses. The causes determine where you're going. If you eat good food, you will have a healthy body. If you eat poison, you're going to die. So what you eat determines your next state. So similarly, the result is going to be determined by the cause. So the causes are our boss. Right? So in our case, we are in the state of transitoriness. We are in the state of changing. So changing means we are determined by there is something which transforms into a result, which transforms into something else. So this means that results should necessarily be determined by the causes. So what is the causes that determine our next destination in our case? It is our mental state. And the mental state is our boss. So that mental state, which is our boss, which determines our next state, is that virtuous or non-virtuous? Is that kind or cruel? If our boss, the causes, which is our boss, if that is kind, we'll be so happy to be with that. Whereas if that is unkind, so unruly, so harsh, cruel, would you be happy? No. So this means that if the boss is so cruel, our mental state, if that is predominantly a negative, what result you're going to expect? Pain. So what is the second teaching? All contaminated things are of the nature of, or are of suffering nature. Which means that all contaminated means our mind which determines, our mind which are contaminated by delusions. Our mind which are contaminated by delusions, they will give rise to suffering nature. Right? Whereas if we are permanent, it's alright. Even if our mind is negative, deluded, it's fine. We are not going to change. It is something else. So we are not being under the power of our cause. But unfortunately, the first teaching says that all composite things are of impermanent nature, which means we have to undergo change. This is our nature. It is not the Buddha created that way. It is our nature, because we are composite, right? So if we are to undergo change, then what determines the next state? Change means a state from original state to a new change, to a new state. So what is that new state going to be like? So that is going to be determined by the first state. So what is that first state? Or what is that cause? What is that was? This is, in our case, is a contaminated mental state. So are contaminated, as long as you are under contamination, contaminated mental state, the result it is going to give rise to is suffering. All contaminated things are of the nature of suffering. So this means that because of our realization of impermanence, we come to know, it gives us a very clear picture that we are going towards. We are going so fast. Towards what? Towards suffering. Because the causes that we are, you know, we are intact with is something so defiled and contaminated. So we are going so fast towards suffering. But don't feel discouraged. The Buddha said, this is the reality that we are in. You should know about it. Unless and until you know that you are sick, you will not look for a cure. If you know that you are sick, then you look for a cure. Similarly, after knowing the kind of plight that we are in, and no exception, every one of us in this plight, once we know that, then what is the cure? Then the Buddha comes up with the cure. It's not something that the Buddha only gives you the bad news. The Buddha comes up with the good news. The good news is that there's a cure to this sickness, this pain, unbearable pain. And yet there's a cure. What is that? What is the third teaching? True. Buddha said that all these problems, they're all just created by this foolish guy called ignorance, which misconceives the reality, which views things totally in totally contradictory to the reality. The reality has said that things simply come into being by interdependency. Things come into being by means of dependent origination. There is no absolute independent nature. But this ignorance that lies, that resides in us so strongly, so well ingrained, things and views things to be existing as independently and inherently. This is the ignorance. And because of this wrong perception, all these contaminations, delusions happen in us. And because of these delusions, it will then propel you in this very fast-paced state to a suffering. So what to do is to control something there in the cause or in the boss. What is that boss? This is the ignorance. You control that ignorance, you remove that ignorance, and then you will have a new boss. You'll have, you know, the wisdom as your boss, who is so compassionate, who is so nice, who has been so kind to you. And then it will not lead you into suffering. Although this state is the same, the impermanence, you know, transitoriness, momentariness is just the same, but you don't have to worry. It will not lead you into the precipice. It will lead you into a wonderful paradise. So, the faster it is, better it is for you. Because the one who is leading you is so kind. You know, it will lead you so fast into a land of paradise. Nirvana, enlightenment. Right? So, now how to deal with this ignorance, the cruel boss? It is by, you know, telling him that you have not been kind. You have been deceiving us. So how to tell him that he has been deceiving us? Because you have been deceiving us, because you have been telling us that the reality is something else, but in true sense, this is not the case. The reality is not independent. There is no independent reality. Everything exists in ways of interdependency, in ways of dependent origination. So, when you get a very clear picture as to how everything is of the nature of emptiness and selflessness, as taught by the Buddha in the third statement of the teaching, then you come to know the reality, and you come to discover the reality. Once you discover the reality, then you will not say yes to this ignorance. You will say no to the ignorance. When you say no to the ignorance, this means you have to combat with this ignorance. Because of this combating, surely you are going to win. Because you have a sound basis. You are being backed by the reality. You correspond to the reality. You represent the reality. Whereas the ignorance is totally baseless. So as you strengthen this realization of the reality, then the ignorance will be eliminated. Right? So what will happen if the ignorance is eliminated? Then what is the fourth teaching?
Nirvana.
Transcending sorrow is nirvana and is peace and ultimate virtue. So, because of eliminating this ignorance is the transcendence of sorrow. Once you eliminate the ignorance, you transcend the ignorance. You transcend sorrow. Because all sorrow are based on this ignorance. When you eliminate the sorrow, then you achieve the ultimate peace and ultimate virtue, which is 100% happiness. Right? So this is our goal. Our mission is accomplished. Right? So now this is the basic foundation for someone seeking personal liberation as well as someone seeking full enlightenment. This is common. Now, what for someone particularly interested in full enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings? So then this needs to be a little bit elaborated, expanded. The same teaching, but a little bit expanded. So you think about, what is the first teaching? All composite things are of impermanent nature. So instead of simply thinking about yourself and the objects you feel attached to and averse to, you think about the impermanent nature of all other sentient beings. And all the objects which create about afflictions in the other sentient beings. You meditate on the impermanent nature of all those things. And what is the next? All contaminated things are of the suffering nature. Again here, you think about how other sentient beings, they are being tormented by suffering because of the ignorance and delusions present in them. And then, the third one, everything is of the nature of emptiness and selflessness. Again the same thing, just as my knowledge of the emptiness helps me eliminate the ignorance, how I wish, that all beings discover this fact, that everything is of the nature of emptiness and selflessness, so that the ignorance in these beings as well be eliminated. And what will happen if they discover as well the same thing? Then there's going to be transcendence of sorrow, not only in you, but in all other sentient beings as well. So for that, for to expand your mental reflection, to be more courageous in expanding this mental reflection towards all other sentient beings, you must be motivated by a sense of genuine affection, a genuine closeness and compassion towards all sentient beings. And how to do that is by the practice of the two techniques, the sevenfold cause-effect relationship to cultivate bodhicitta, and the method of equalizing and exchanging oneself for others to cultivate bodhicitta. So with these two. Okay, now in a practical sense, in a daily life, whether you are in abbey or whether you are outside working, doing your daily job, whatever, so one should lead a life of honesty. Always be so honest. So this will help you cultivate the ethical discipline. Right? And always be compassionate. This will help you nurture the seed of bodhicitta within yourself. So this is what we can do even while we are engaged in our daily works. Not necessarily that you should be in abbey, that you should be in a monastery or nunnery. You know, even while you are doing your daily work, be always honest, truthful, and warm-hearted. Right? Yeah. And then, under no circumstance, give in to anger or hostility. Of course, there's going to be instances where anger, hostility, and so forth can arise in you. But from your side, don't ever give in to them. Even if it arises, you give a chance to yourself after that moment, if that is correct. And don't say yes. Simply say no. I'm wrong in having done this. If you say this, if you realize, if at least you say no to your own negative action of anger, this in itself is a great remedy to anger. And then if possible, try to make conviction, commitment, that henceforth I'm not going to repeat this anger. Henceforth I'm not going to submit myself to this anger. Right? Again, next time, anger can arise. Again, you do the same thing. No. I'm supposed to be a practitioner. And I promised, I committed myself not to give in to the anger. And again, I, you know, give myself to anger. Give in myself to anger. No. How coward you are. Tell yourself. And you make another commitment. I'm not going to give in to anger again. How shame it would be for me to give in to anger while I claim myself to a practitioner. Say this and make another commitment that I'm not going to give in to anger again. Right? So that way, then you see that over time, anger diminishes in strength. And at one point, when there is a situation where anger is to arise, instead of anger arising, when there is anger arising, do you think there is a joy accompanying it? No. Mental disturbance. So when there is a situation arising for anger to arise, instead of anger arising, there's a sense of joy happening in you. So this is indication of your success, victory over anger. So let me end this class with a very short narration of a real story connected with one of my teachers, I think 30-something years solitary retreatant in the hills, by the name Venerable Jambal Denzin La, Most Venerable Jambal Denzin La, and he spent about more than 30 years in solitary meditation among the hills, in solitary retreat. Say, what happened was that in his early days of his practice, he had to, you know, climb down the hill to get to fetch water. And there, the person who took care of the water happened to be really a horrible person. Horrible in the sense, you know. So usually in the Tibetan tradition, when there is a monk or nun, and particularly someone who is a practitioner, you always tend to be of service to the person. But in this case, the person, instead of that, just treating the retreatant as just an ordinary person, and as though an object of bully. Just bullying. Always complaining, never smiling at all. And he didn't know how to smile. So, then, Venerable Jamila, he would, before he went to fetch water, he would first of all, you know, think about that man. Oh, I had to encounter with this man. So how should I respond to him? Oh no, I'm supposed to be a practitioner. I'm in this retreat hut. So when I come there, I cannot blame anything on him because he is not claiming himself as a practitioner. It is me who claims myself to be a practitioner. So when it comes to a situation where there's going to be heated debate or something coming up, I'm going to be the one who is going to give in. Give in is the sense, I'm going to be the one who is going to practice patience. Then he would make commitment, and then he would climb down. Again he would murmur, hey, again, this is the kind of response from the other person. What for you have come here? It's so late. Always some form of complaint. Oh, there's no time, please go away, go away. Like that. And the time for the retreatant is so precious. And then, first moment, you know, Gyanlab, my teacher would be mindful. Oh, I'm a practitioner, I'm not supposed to do that. I'm to practice patience. Let me do anything to me. Even if he beats me, it's fine. And then, he is so annoying to the extent that you cannot bear it. Then you also burst into, you know, anger. Then you somehow you got the water. You took it. And you're there. Then he would again reflect about the whole episode. What happened? Oh no. How shameful you are. He didn't say that he's a practitioner. But I'm supposed to be a practitioner. I'm here as a practitioner. Everybody else respect me for being a practitioner. But look, how poorly I performed. You know, I gave in to anger. How sad. You're supposed to be a practitioner. Practitioner means something who is going to achieve victory over the delusions and above all anger. And yet, you so easily gave in to anger. This is how you are, how vulnerable you are, how impoverished you are. So next time, don't do it. Don't do it. Next time, let him kill you. Let him beat you. But don't give in to anger. And then he would make commitment, new commitments. He would scold himself, all these things. Again the next day, climbing down with the same can, water can, and then fetching water. Again the same person, hey, again the same thing, you know, something new to say. Something new, horrible to say. And again, oh, I'm a practitioner. I'm not supposed to give in to anger. Okay, sorry, sorry. And you say sorry, and the person would really take advantage of it. And then gradually, again, knowing that, oh look, how horrible this man is. I'm always taking the loss. I'm trying to be the loser. I'm trying to give the victory over the other person. And yet he's taking advantage of it. You know, again anger arises. Again you fight with that person, and a person, you know, retreats a bit, and you get water. Again you go back. He did that years, you know, days, weeks, months and years. And imagine how many years it took him. And he told me it took him 6 years. At one point, after about 6 years, he said that at one point, however horrible, you know, shameless words, you know, the other person, however annoying the other person expresses himself, there's a sense of tranquility. There's a sense of equanimity. No sense of joy, no sense of sadness or anger arising. Just a sense of neutrality there. He was so amazed. And then, come back. Oh, this is not what you're seeking. Just the neutrality. Neutral state is not what you're seeking. You should be feeling compassionate towards this person. Because the other person, by so doing, because of his coming in contact with you, he's become angry. Because of his coming in contact with you, he's accumulating negative karmas. Because of which, you are responsible for the other person's suffering in the future. You should be feeling compassionate. Then he upgraded himself in his meditation. Then, over time, at one point, he was so amazed. The more, you know, unruly the other person was, annoying the other person was, he feels more and more joyful. He feels more and more compassionate. Then he thought, this is his victory over anger. It took him 6 years. Right? So therefore, combating with anger, combating with negative emotions is not at all an easy task. It'll take time. It'll take energy. It'll take time. energy and effort, skillfulness, wisdom, all these things. So you should be ready in your daily life, particularly when you're outside in society, whether in the abbey itself or another society, you're bound to face with these frictions. So under such circumstance, it is really very important to be mindful of the story of Venerable Jambal Tenzin La. You know, 6 years of attempt to, you know, counter anger. If we are able to simply go carry on with this meditation, anger can arise, again make new commitment. Anger can arise, again make new commitment. And then go study more of Shantideva's text, 6th chapter. The faults of anger, the benefits of patience. You try to study, you try to reflect, study that text to see what means to you adopt under what circumstance. So try to be so precise in this knowledge, in this reflection, and in this meditation. If you do that, I'm very sure that at one point you will truly have a spurring sense of joy when you think about the sources of anger. You know, instead of anger arising, there's a deep sense of compassion dawning in you. 100% sure. Yeah. Okay, so if that happens, then this will open you to generating bodhicitta. Because the worst of the enemy of bodhicitta is anger. This is the worst of the enemy. Self-cherishing, it is, you know, the opposite. It is the counterforce of bodhicitta. But the worst of all, even worse than self-cherishing, is the anger, hostility, resentment. So make sure that you don't give in yourself to this, you know, the vicious emotion of anger. Don't give into it. And once you are successful, then it opens to generating bodhicitta. And if there is a, you know, glimpse of bodhicitta arising in you, then all other teachings will, you know, naturally just be attracted towards you. All this will, in this very life, you will, even if you are in a, such a desperate situation as sickness or, you know, unfortunate things happening, but deep down you have a very calm state of mind. No one can give you that. It is only the bodhicitta who can give you that. Right? Compassion towards others. Incredible. Number one. And then, after that, it is 100% sure that you will have a favorable state, favorable rebirth in the next life. Right? That. And then, because of that bodhicitta, you become so keen on searching for something which can be of benefit for others. And what is that something which is of the best use and benefit for others? It is the wisdom of emptiness. And then you will get the wisdom of emptiness as well without any effort. So everything, you are like, you become like a magnet. This bodhicitta that arises in you is going to be like a magnet to attract all good qualities. Right? And it's, the magnet doesn't know, a real magnet doesn't know which is a good iron or which is a bad iron. But this magnet is very strange. It attracts only the good qualities and repels all bad qualities. This is an amazing magnet. Just cultivate this bodhicitta. It's amazing, amazing. And if you do that, all Buddhas, you don't really need to pray to Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. They all come down and look at you and say, "You wonderful child of mine." And this is the victory. This is the accomplishment of our mission. Right? Okay, so for bodhicitta, read the chapter 8 of Shantideva's text. This is a wonderful thing. And to encounter anger, to, you know, to overcome, to combat anger, which is the worst of the enemy of bodhicitta, you read chapter 6. And chapter 1 and chapter 10 to receive inspiration for, you know, cultivate bodhicitta. Okay, that's it.